7:50, 10 minutes before 8 o'clock Eastern Time on this Friday morning. And Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here on this Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, thank you. It's good always to be here, and especially this week. And we'll try to get Bob to do the post-mortem next week.
Oh, by the way, maybe Bob will join us for a minute Tuesday morning. That would be cool.
Absolutely.
If we could do that. And our apologies, we weren't able to get through to him today. You know, I asked both Richard Stone and Mort Zuckerman if there was a way to define their role as chairman, meaning historically, and Richard, of course, served under the Obama administration, or served during, I should say, and Mort served as conference chair when George W. Bush was in power, so I got their perspective quickly on that. Now, Bob Sugarman is in, not that you're speaking for him, but how do we define this era that, you know, began this year for him? How would you say it would be classified in terms of his role in this whole Jewish leadership scene?
Somewhere between hectic and crazy. But that characterizes every chairman's term and every day, because people don't see the work of the conference. We don't have a PR department. We don't publicize most of what we do, and because we don't want to. And it's the behind-the-scenes stuff that the chairman and we engage in day-to-day, and which many organizations do, that you don't see, but that have real results. And now we face such a complex of issues. You know, he came into the middle of the Iran, right, heightened Iran debate, the Syria war, the developments in Egypt. All of these things have much broader ramifications, let alone struggles at the UN and elsewhere.
So, I mean, you're going to think this is a funny question, but this is the week to ask. I'm taking advantage. When the chair comes in, do they need crash courses and a whole bunch of different stuff? I mean, they walk into the White House, they've got to be really well-read on a lot of issues. And I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen in your career, people in their 30s and 40s who are in specific industries who'll take off a year, you know, to study certain things. Do they have to go through that type of orientation?
First of all, most of them had to be by the nature of the position to be involved, because you have to be the president of a member, right, organization, which means you were exposed, some for, like Bob Sugarman, for many years to the work of the conference, to the issues. He was chairman of ADL, and certainly all of them are people who read. Some of them hire assistants during their tenure to help filter out the information, and of course, we brief them before any kind of a major meeting or on major developments.
Right.
So, yeah, it's
got to be the most,
a lot of homework.
That's it. That's the word. Exactly. It's got to be one of the most nerve-wracking things, especially at the beginning, you know, and whether someone's really familiar with the issue or not, just, you know, knowing what you're doing. I mean, you've mentioned this a million times. You walk into rooms where you're representing the Jewish people, the interests of Jews worldwide, the State of Israel, etc., and you just pray that the right words come out of your mouth.
Every time, because you never know how the right word can make a difference, or, God forbid, the wrong word can have a deleterious effect. I've seen both of those things when people, sometimes out of good intention, but not choosing their words carefully, can say something to a leader, and you see the reaction, and you know that your ship is beginning to sink.
Right.
You try to save it. But the you know, most of the leaders have had the experience. They're sensitive. They know they're not there to score points or for themselves. It's not their egos. It's really an awesome responsibility.
Say the least. And I know that this coming Tuesday night, obviously the Jewish community, the business community, world of government will all be represented really nicely. Were you surprised at the international reaction, how so many people you work with from different countries and represent those countries here in the U.S. are coming to pay tribute on Tuesday?
I'm frankly shocked by the whole thing. As you know, we don't have a development department, we don't have fundraisers, the last dinner like this we did was 20 years ago,
right,
but the response was so far beyond that everything we had geared to or been prepared for was way overwhelmed. I mean, the fact that we had a closed registration a few days ago and that we had to turn away, and I apologize to those we did turn away, but there was no way that they could be seated comfortably, that we ran all the maximum limits that the hotel allows. And we have security requirements that limited when we could take reservations. But I think it's a testament to the understanding and the feeling in the community and a desire to be there. Nobody knows anything about the program, so nobody came because of the speaker, literally. And even I don't know.
They know they might
follow the program yet.
They know they might see you. That's about it.
No, but seriously, they don't. know anything about the program, and yet this amazing response, and people were very generous, and it's really overwhelming.
Unbelievable. All right. With all the celebration that we're talking about, obviously a very sad event this week, the passing of Hav Avadia Yosef. The gathering for his funeral in Jerusalem was just staggering. I mean, I still can't get over no matter what number you want to believe or not believe, the photos were simply amazing. I'm sure you agree. Is there a way for you to encapsulate all this, the influence and the incredible leadership that he had in the State of Israel, both during the time he was chief rabbi and, of course, on the political scene as well, to get this number of people to come out and say goodbye to you? You have to have had the most amazing, influential career. How would you sum it up?
Well, I think there are several answers to your question. One is that this is a tremendous demonstration of political strength from the Kavod HaTorah, the honoring a great sage, and it's a statement by the Sephardic community, but also to see that non-Sephardim joined in massive numbers. I have many friends who went, and frankly, I wish I could have gone if it weren't for all the preparations. And the fact that you had a turnout that certainly was the largest funeral in Israel's history,
right,
has to make a lot of people look at this anew. I would hope that the Shas party will not, you know, fall into internal disputes. I think he tried to indicate the leadership preferences. But one of the most interesting things, and you know, his history is really interesting, how he came to, you know, he was born in Baghdad, and he came to Yerushalayim when he was 4, and he got smicha at 20, ordination at 20, and then went to Egypt in 47 in Cairo to work on the Besdin, and was the deputy chief rabbi. The whole history and how then he came back and became a dayan, judge in the Israeli religious courts. But it wasn't something inherited. It wasn't something imposed on him. It's something he really earned. And the amazing development that somebody yesterday sent me a photo of Avadia Yosef speaking at the rally for Solidarity Day for Soviet Jews in New York,
wow,
1974.
Wow.
When I saw it, my mind literally exploded. I remember it so well because he came, you know, in the full regalia.
Right.
And he stood there and he spoke. It was powerful. But frankly, it slipped everybody's mind. I sent it to all the people who involved at the time.
And half the people listening now probably were there.
were there, but nobody thought of it
right
at the time because it was 1974. It's
right
a long time ago. But the fact that he came to New York and he spoke at the Solidarity Rally, and I remember his words were very powerful in you know, his style and his regal look really added to it.
Malcolm,
so it's a great loss overall.
Oh, no question about it. Malcolm, you opened with, you know, future of the Shas party. With such a unifying figure at the helm, isn't it impossible for there not to be a split at this point, or at least, I mean, and I'm not wishing on anybody, I'm just saying this from a point of analysis. I mean, wouldn't you, the way these things go historically, wouldn't you expect that there are going to be different camps emerging?
Well, I understand that there were already, and the people were speaking about the funeral in those terms, that again, you don't know what's real and what's not real, but I think that you don't have somebody who will step in and have both his religious authority and establish the political recognition that he achieved. Aryeh Deri obviously is now the leader of Shas,
right.
But there are a lot of factions, and hopefully they'll come together. I think only time will tell what the next steps will be.
Can there be a shiva call of such high profile in Israel where the prime minister's visit does not turn into a political discussion?
No, it's not possible, and it wasn't possible. And they got into it with him about the eight yeshivas and the pain and the suffering that's going on in the community, which shows that his kids have this sense of communal responsibility that even during the Shiva that they were able to think of the bigger picture.
8 o'clock in the morning on a Friday is America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. We congratulate and wish Mazel Tov to Malcolm Hohenlein. His 25 years at the helm of the Conference of Presidents will be recognized this coming Tuesday night at their big tribute gala. Malcolm, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which oversees the destruction of Syria's arsenal, won the Nobel Peace Prize today. I need to turn to you because you always can enlighten us whether this is a legitimate group or one that can't be relied on in this area. What's your reaction to their victory?
Well, it's a legitimate group, and I think it's a focus on Syria. I don't think that 6 months ago anybody would have said that they would be the recipient of the award. They go into dangerous situations, and in this case, a civil war, to carry out the mission of trying to dismantle and to control chemical weapons. We saw the pictures on Syrian TV over the week about the first dismantling or alleged dismantling of some of the weapons. They're actually going after the production, and the UN has said that they can finish the job by June of next June, and they're talking about having to enlarge the mission. They need a lot more people to do it. It's also a very expensive undertaking, but it seems to be progressing, although obviously I don't think anybody really trusts that there will be full compliance, and we don't know if they're giving up all the stockpiles. We don't know what other things they have. What we do know is that the deaths of over 110,000 people was by conventional weapons largely.
Right.
So the chemical weapons removal is important and removes a threat, but it doesn't end the danger. And maybe people think also about what Israel did, the favor in taking out that nuclear reactor, and if it hadn't been, what we would be dealing with today.
What's your reaction while we're on the subject of Nobel Prizes, that again, Israel is at the forefront when it comes to the Nobel Prize, this time in chemistry?
Well, I think there are a couple things that interesting reaction. First of all, of the three, two hold Israeli citizenship.
Right.
And the number of Jews also is a source of pride, in not just Israelis, but
right.
in various categories. Including the guys who discovered the Higgs boson, the French recipient is Jewish, is a survivor, which they don't mention, but Higgs is a boycotter of Israel, so it's an interesting combination. Look, I think that the issue of the brain drain from Israel is a serious one, and the fact that these people had to go out of Israel, not because Israel doesn't have incredible opportunities. We see the creativity, but we also see the number of people who leave who should remain in Israel because they're such a great asset, and instead of going to Silicon Valley and other places. And I hope that we can, as time progresses, and the building of a Technion, $100 million going into Technion from this Chinese investors and others, will be a big benefit in terms of being able to retain really top-notch scientists, thinkers, others.
I mean, I've read about the brain drain, but I didn't think it was that serious. It sounds, for the way you're saying, it's a very serious situation.
Well, if you travel in high-tech circles, you will see how many Israelis are here.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't mean that they've abandoned Israel.
Right.
I'm not criticizing them because
right,
the opportunities are here, and they have to have an American presence
right.
To do it, but it's something that was highlighted, I think, by this, and a number of the Israeli papers were commenting on it.
Yeah, I saw it as a concept and as something that happens. I just didn't realize that there's an epidemic. I don't know if you'd call it an epidemic, but I didn't realize that it's to the degree that you're describing. New York Times, when Iranian diplomats sit down in Geneva next Tuesday with the U.S. and five other world powers for a new round of talks about Iran's nuclear program, Congress will not have a seat at the table, but that does not mean it will not have a voice. With a tough new Iran sanctions bill teed up in the Senate following the overwhelming passage of similar legislation by the House in July, lawmakers are poised to do one of two things. They could tighten the screws on Iran's leaders in a way that helps produce a nuclear deal, or they could foul up delicate diplomacy at a crucial moment. Which one of those do you think they're heading toward, Malcolm?
Perhaps both. Let's just look at both aspects of it. What we're hearing now is that there is a proposal that the Russians, the United States, and Khomeini have cooked up. Some sources say that it means that they will have keep them 2 to 3 years away from a nuclear weapon. That's a mistake. Anything that doesn't involve the complete dismantling, because we understand the Iranians are saying they want to keep the ability to enrich to 20%. They keep claiming the right. There is no right. There is no need. They can have peaceful nuclear power, like 17, like Canada, Mexico, and others, without having enrichment. They can buy this stuff, and they have 200 years of oil and gas for their domestic needs, so that's not the issue. Somebody put it well, that we're being, that they're using tranquilizing words to chloroform the West.
Hmm.
And the fears that we had expressed in the past, that these new proposals, they're not coming with new proposals, they're coming so far with regurgitated old proposals, and the charm offensive continues, although we've seen the split where Zarif, the foreign minister, at one time said it was bad that he met with the, and that what he did, and then he said no. Then Khamenei, I don't know if he reprimanded him, then he came out the other way, then he checked into a hospital. The fact is that Iran's economy is, some say, 18 months from collapse. That was Steinitz, or even more, but they've lost $100 billion. In damages to the economy. Inflation's 40%. They desperately want to get out of under the sanctions regime. They're going to find any means possible. But everything we see from Rouhani, the more information we get, his role even before he was the Iranian nuclear interlocutor and negotiator, that he wrote from 1995 to 2001, he was head of the Air Defense Forces, where He's the one who initiated the deals with North Korea, because it was during that time that all this stuff started coming from North Korea to Iran. During his tenure, he gave an interview May 27th, and he says, you know, I lied, we obfuscated, this is the way you do it. He said, when did they get the yellow cake? 2004. When did they get this? 2003. All the time when he was the negotiator. And we see statements today where they talk about taqiyya, which is the ability, the right to lie if for serving an ultimate purpose of Islam, as they interpret it. And we see how North Korea now threatened the United States because we have some ships in South Korea. This is the model. And they are not, if we don't learn the lesson from North Korea, if we don't apply it and understand that we have to have absolute restrictions, and I think the United States has said they don't accept this, they're not going to remove the sanctions. We have to make sure that's the case. I think Congress is very committed to making sure that that is the case, to the degree that they will again be involved, and hopefully this stalemate will be passed.
So these sanctions are stronger than the ones in the past?
The new sanctions are strong. The State Department isn't to hold off until after the meeting. I think that the sooner you do it, the better. That will help any chance of moving the Iranians. It's not something that should come post facto.
They have
to see that we are really serious. Iran will do whatever it can. It will create these packages. It will, until it really dismantles the infrastructure. They're saying that they'll give up Qum, the facility at Qum, but they have many others. They're adding centrifuges now. They say, well, we'll limit the centrifuges. We'll limit, you know, how high we enrich. But the breakout is immediate. And now the one proposal was that it'll keep them 2 to 3 years away. But once they have the infrastructure, there is no way, you know, that the Iranians under this regime are going to honor that in the longer run. And
right.
Then we'll all look back and say, how did we fall victim to this?
This is
now the warning in advance.
This is Washington is a reaction to Bibi in the UN, or this was in place long ago?
Well, the United States has tried to engage them, and I think it's not a reaction to Bibi. Bibi's speech was a reaction to what was happening. But it's really the Iranians who are trying to put a new face on it. But you keep getting these conflicting reports, you know, about what they actually said and what they mean, and that Khamenei authorized it. Look at the appointments that he's making to the cabinet. And we don't have time now, but if you look at that, you will see they're putting hardliners, really tough guys who opposed any negotiations with less people, as the head of the National Security Council, the Minister of Justice has a terrible record. I mean, they're all bad people.
Because this is who he's allied with politically. I mean, that's the...
Exactly.
You've said this from way before the election. You said this...
His people.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the if the West falls for this one, we only have ourselves to blame, because they know the rules, they know how these guys play, they know what the intent is. Look, if they can get him to really dismantle the missile system, and we don't have to go to work and the nuclear weapons program, that would be fine.
Right, and Bibi would agree with that.
That's right. But also yesterday, if you'll notice, how Israel engaged in a long-range flight test simulation with in-air refueling, etc. But what was interesting is that it was advertised. And usually these things go on, but they're not made public. Here, it was deliberately including photos from the exercise, showing them refueling in midair, I think that that is a very strong message to certain parties.
See, the and I think it's increasingly obvious from Bibi's words and what you've always told us. Obviously, this has to be fought on many different fronts. That's why, you know, when people approach you with, let's just go bomb them, you know, routine, you probably get even more and more frustrated than you did in the past already. Because obviously, there's so many different angles that this has to be fought through. If they go ahead and make a demonstration of strength like you just described, it may take some type of physical military presence to, you know, to help remind them about the power that the United States and or Israel has. It doesn't
like Syria. It's only the credibility of the threat,
right,
of military.
It doesn't mean you go out and carpet bag the entire place. It means that sometimes there has to be subtle hints that, you know, through actions that remind them what the good side could do.
That, exactly, and that the people of Iran who are fed up with the regime also have to see that the West is serious. And the problem is that look at the reaction of a country. I've heard for a second, but it's very much related. When you're talking about the image in the region, what we did to Egypt this week with the cutting of aid sent such a negative message. When they see what we're doing on Iran, so Russia takes advantage of it at the same time that they play the game with these guys, so they try to play both sides. We see the Saudis, the Gulf, and others just in total frustration and alienation, and then the message here is: if we don't have a credible medical military threat, if all options are not seen as being on the table by the Iranians, not by us but by them, then all the deals will ultimately just be delaying tactics where they gain time. Even the plutonium reactor, it is more dangerous in a sense than the uranium enrichment, because you can build it, a bomb in a year. You can put them on the Shahab 3, which has a more limited payload, and the plutonium bomb is much lighter. So it's not just to stopping the enrichment. It's stopping this alternative facility that they're building in Iraq. It is going after the whole infrastructure of their nuclear weapons capacity. And they can have peaceful nuclear availability, but it doesn't require all of this infrastructure and whatever secret facilities that we don't even know about.
Can I ask you something? And if you can't answer it, just say so. You're already telling me you can't. Theoretically, if there was an event in your honor, right, or somebody wanted to, in theory, and members of the opposition to the Iranian regime that you just described would show up, show support, make their voice heard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do their colleagues and families suffer back home?
Well, the ones who might theoretically show up at the event are people who are out front, whose families largely have come out, but who have already broken with the regime and have courageously put themselves out front, telling the truth about what's really going on, trying to mobilize support, and so I guess the risk is limited.
And if the American media wanted access to those people on a regular basis, they could have it.
They have it.
And if they're not reporting what they have to say about the situation, it's their choice, meaning the American media's choice.
It's absolutely their choice, and it's people who know firsthand. One such person theoretically could be somebody who came with Khamenei in 1979 on his plane, was a deputy prime minister, then turned against him and was in jail for many years and now is in the United States. He speaks out, and his insights, because he understands the mentality and he knows most of the players. Rafsanjani has been, Rouhani has been around since almost the beginning of this regime. So they know these guys and they know how they think, and they are able to share and give us perspective that we, thinking as we do, coming without the experience that they've had, don't necessarily get.
And can I assume that people like the ones we just described are in regular contact with leaders in the State of Israel? Would that be a good...
They're in contact with people here, they're in contact with the Jewish community, they're in contact with the experts and scholars.
Right, they're not holding back from approaching anybody who might be able to help their cause, let's put it that way.
Right.
Iran accused four workers of trying to sabotage its nuclear power program, tacitly blaming Israel for the plot. Now, is there a germ of suspicion here where, you know, sometimes we say, wink, wink, Israel probably was involved, but, you know, obviously it wouldn't be said, or is this simply propaganda where there's no way that Israel could have had a role in this?
So far, there's no evidence that Israel had any role in it, and they would have played it up differently, I think, if they had more convincing evidence of it. This is a blanket charge that they used. So I don't know, but I haven't seen anything that would indicate that.
Israel hopes the U.S. decision to cut aid to Egypt will not affect the two countries' historic peace deal, according to a cabinet minister on Thursday, insisting that the Israeli-Egyptian ties remain as close as ever. Now, I am no military expert, I'm no political expert, but to use the words close as ever when it comes to Israel and Egypt, isn't that a little bit of a stretch?
No, actually, the military and security cooperation is really outstanding.
Are you shocked by this? If I told you this 6 months ago, would you have predicted it?
Yes, under the generals, it has improved steadily. Even under Morsi, by the way, it started because the military needed Israel. It wasn't out of love of Israel initially, but the
right. Necessity.
Cooperation is the way, because Egypt found that all of the things they were tolerating, part of Hamas and the part of in the Gaza and the Sinai, were coming back to hurt them, and they lost control. It is really no man's land. It's a wanton wasteland now in Sinai with all of these terrorist organizations, and they were every day attacking Egyptian military, and Israel gave permission for them to enhance and bulk up their presence there a lot, and that's why the decision not to send aid is even more. It's not a total cutoff of aid, and they say it's temporary. It means, but they don't get F-16s, they're not getting helicopters and certain spare parts, which they need when they're, although they do allow them the anti-terrorism stuff. But the message, when they're on the front line there now going after the terrorists, and maybe they're doing it in extreme ways, whatever, but the fact is that they're fighting a terrible enemy in the Sinai that kills every day, and I think they've had 50 dead and 250 injured in 2 weeks, and during the annual anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, we saw
right.
the violence.
Yeah, that
they even
right.
fired a missile, some sort of a rocket, a propelled grenade, through a satellite dish in one of the wealthy suburbs of Cairo. I mean, this is not. They're fighting an important battle against al-Qaeda, against other terrorist groups, and trying to regain some control.
Is your organization in Washington trying to convince the White House and Congress to keep the aid going?
Well, Congress has not been involved. This was a decision without Congress's involvement, and many members of Congress have spoken up and been upset. And it's surprising that after, the involvement of Congress on Syria, that they weren't even consulted on this decision. The administration has the right to make it. But Israel has expressed its public disappointment, even alarm. So have others. And again, it's because of the message. Others will make up perhaps the financial end, but the Russians then say, well, we're going to, we'll step in and provide. I don't think that Egypt can shift over back to the Russian equipment, nor do I think they want to. But this is, the message here, I really don't understand, and I don't think it was smart. Maybe because it's a limited action, they have the ability to be flexible with it, which I hope they will be. But again, it doesn't play well when Egypt is trying to move. The generals, at least, are moving against the terrorists. We want to see them move better on human rights and other things, but the situation there is really terrible. The economy is
I asked you this last week, and but now I have to ask again in the context of this discussion: is Egypt going to have to, out of necessity, have an increased presence in Gaza just to control the situation?
They have said that they've sent drones.
No, but I'm
over
saying,
Gaza.
But I'm saying even more. Like down the road, could we see like a real movement where they take over the place?
I don't know if take over, but they certainly would like to see Hamas removed. At the same time that Mr. Erdogan, our good friend in Turkey, is hosting Mashal of Hamas and trying, it seems, to gain some influence there, perhaps because they've lost influence everywhere else. I mean, he had this policy of zero problems with our neighbors, and there is zero countries with whom he doesn't have problems today. He had invested a lot with Syria, invested in other things, and I think more and more people are seeing his erratic nature and the decisions he makes. He even attacked Israel again for apologizing too late over the Mavi Marmara incident.
Right.
But he's hosting Hamas. 73% of the people in Turkey reject it. They don't want him to do it. And we see the increased pressure on Hamas because they've cut off from Iran's funding, from Qatar's major funding for them. there, feeling the pressure because of the events in Sinai from the Egyptian army, and now he's going to be the lifeline for them.
Is he democratically elected? He's acting like a dictator who does what's best for them and doesn't worry about what's best for the people or what the people want.
Well, both are true. He was democratically elected, but you know, he's put hundreds of generals in jail. Hundreds of the media is certainly not free in the same way it was. It's many of the Ataturk reforms and traditions have been curtailed. So to describe him as certainly as a democratic force, I think would be the country is and the people I think want to be.
Right, but he's not necessarily.
I don't think you can say Erdogan is.
Yeah, he's not behaving that way. All right, I haven't done this in a while, Malcolm. Usually I stay with my own list, but I mean we have a couple of minutes left. Hundreds of topics we still haven't gotten to over the last couple of weeks. What do we need to know in terms of the top of the list today?
Well, I think the developments with Egypt could have longer-term ramifications. Certainly the upcoming meeting next week, before we talk again of the P5+1 with Iran, is going to be very important. What proposals are put forward, people should read carefully about what is really being said and what is being proposed. There is a proposal on the table. The Iranians said they want a new one. Secretary Kerry said that we're not doing new ones until you give us the old ones. So those two things are, and also, of course, what happens in Washington with the showdown internally, which may or may not be resolved in the coming days. Part of it certainly looks like it's moving towards resolution.
The shutdown showdown.
Shutdown showdown, very good.
Thank you very much.
It's a headline. I think these, in the next couple of days, all of these will be very important issues. And then once Congress reconvenes, do they move on the Iran sanctions despite the State Department's request? And the message of Israel's training exercise will sink in the next day or so.
Do we care about the Russian reaction to the U.S. sanctions?
Well, it looks like the Russians and the U.S. are on the same page. Lavrov, the foreign minister, said that it'll take six months we could have this all resolved, we could have an agreement. The Russians obviously are champing at the bit to play a diplomatic role and reassert their presence and their standing as a world power, despite their internal problems and diminished status. But this has projected them in a new role, and out of coming out of Syria, if we do the same in Iran, I mean, this is going to be some sort of a new format or model. The administration has always wanted to internationalize solutions, and I think that is their general approach. I think that we have to be very careful, though, about with whom we're making common cause and the criteria, because our interests don't always overlap long term.
Yeah. All right, Mazal Tov to you. We'll see you Tuesday, and we'll speak Friday. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.